It's delightful to see you here this evening, and I pray that the time will pass in a profitable manner. Ty mentioned to me a few weeks ago that there has not been a sermon here on gambling, in as far as he can remember, maybe forever. There was not any found on the website, and I thought I had spoken on it at some point, but had not. I cannot get to Calvinism tonight and then leave a gap for next week, and so I decided to put that off for 2 weeks until we get to that, and so I thought this is the best time to cover this material and then go ahead with some other things that we had planned. This is certainly a needed discussion because of the society in which we live. I wish it were not so. I wish there were people who had the attitude that was prevalent when I was growing up, that gamblers were looked down upon and it was frowned upon and people just didn't do it unless they wanted to be called trash. Now, there are clever skits and catchy jingles you hear on the radio. They're subsidized many times by our tax dollars because they're trying to promote the lottery and various kinds of gambling. One billboard that I saw said, "A small wager can make a big difference in your quality of life." Boy, is that true. It can absolutely destroy it. It can destroy your whole life itself. On the news, they're very careful to give you the winners. They seem to be everywhere. They don't mention all the people who have broken families, those who have committed suicide, those who have lost everything they have, and all the other negatives. They do point out, so-and-so won, he won this lottery, but he won it at the expense of all the losers. How utterly sad. America has changed. In my youth, gamblers had a very bad reputation. Parents and spouses were ashamed of those who engaged in gambling. Now even grandparents gamble. Little old ladies gamble, and they will tell anybody they want to how serious they are about it. They'll do it many times in their own living room. What is gambling exactly? It's very important that we define our topic. Gambling is a game of chance. It's for money. It is a wager on a risk. You risk what is yours in order to get what is another's, but give nothing in return. Basically, gambling is greed. Basically, gambling is covetousness. And these passages that we're about to see will illustrate that, and these statements here illustrate it. Now, what can justify gambling? Well, sometimes people say, well, all of life is a risk. If you're a farmer, we know the risks that farmers take. If you cross a street, we know what kind of risk that is. If you drive in Nashville, you're really taking your life in your hands. That is a risk. If gambling is wrong, then it's wrong to drive in Nashville, it's wrong to cross the street, it's wrong to farm, because those are risks as well. Well, gambling is not a risk. People who say this have forgotten or ignored the definition. Gambling is a wager on a risk agreed upon by the participants. Now, a farmer does take risks. A farmer takes risks. That's no doubt about that. He may lose everything, but his profit doesn't come at the expense of another, and he would just as soon the risk not be there. And the less risk he can have, the better. But however that may be, the Bible does authorize farming. Paul himself, in illustrating his right to take wages, said, "For our sakes, no doubt this is written, that he who plows," now that's what a farmer does, "should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be partaker of his hope." Now, what is he saying by this? He's saying basically that when you plow, you do so in hope, but your hopes may be blasted. You may get no rain all year. And when you get no rain, you won't have good crops. You had hope for a lot of good crops. Bumper crops. You won't get it if you don't get the rain. Even worse, if you get flooding. As Paul Harvey used to say, along the Mississippi, when it would flood, the water did far more damage than the lack of water in destroying crops. So either of those two extremes, which the farmer cannot control, and he's in trouble. I've known for many years farmers who were in trouble for these very reasons. The threshing is when they would go, as we've talked before, on a hill, usually a flat, packed place. And they would take the grain, they would use a sledge or the feet of the oxen or something else like it. They would crush the hard shells off the seed, throw them up in the air. The wind, since they're up on a hill, would blow it away. And the heavy seed would fall down. They'd put it in bags and gather it, and they'd take the chaff, that stuff that covered the seed, and burn it typically. Now, these are farming terms. We could notice bukus of others. But we don't have to do that. We can just simply say the New Testament authorizes it. Though there's a risk, this is not gambling. This is not covetousness. This is simply a job and the person's trying to live. Sometimes people say, well, the Bible never condemns gambling. Listen very carefully. It is a shame that some people who talk have never studied anything that is logical at all. But what this amounts to is an unstated major premise. It's just giving you the minor premise, and you're to assume that what they're saying is true. Let me illustrate this. If the street is wet, you pick out a certain street and you say, if that street is wet, then that means it rained. That's the major premise. Now, the minor premise is the street is wet. Somebody comes and says, yeah, you know that street out there, it's wet. Well, if your major premise is true, then it rained. Now, if you told a lie about it, then there are other ways a street can be wet. But if you have a street that can't be wet any other way except raining, if it's wet, it rained. It is wet, therefore it rained. Okay, people start with this. The street is wet, therefore, and then they reason any way they want to. They overlook the major premise. Let's look at it now in regard to what we just said. The major premise is the Bible never condemns gambling. So what it says is everything not expressly condemned in the New Testament is allowed. Not even a gambler wants to hold to that. Let's put it in the same kind of a syllogism we had in the first three. Everything not expressly condemned in the New Testament is allowed. Rape is not expressly condemned, therefore rape is allowed. Oh, wait a minute, we're talking about gambling, not rape, aren't we? But do you see a point here? There is no limit of things that are authorized if you argue by silence. I put together a very short list. What would be allowed? Larceny, suicide, embezzling, bootlegging, gambling, ice cream for the Lord's Supper? I don't know of any passage that says, thou shalt not do these things. Are they authorized? No. I don't know of a passage that says, I can't break into your house tonight and steal anything I want. It didn't say me personally. Maybe I'm not stealing, maybe I'm just borrowing for the rest of my life. Maybe I can borrow. Borrowing's not bad, is it? And you see how you start manipulating words in order to get what you want. That's what happens in gambling, and I'll show that in just a minute. Hebrews 5:14 is one passage among many that tells us we have to reason properly on scriptures and not merely make assumptions. Hebrews 5:14 tells us, but solid food belongs to those who are of full age. That is, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Not everything mentioned in Scripture is spelled out in black and white. And I hope to elaborate on this just a little bit in a while. But this expression here in Hebrews 5:14, when he says they have their senses exercised to discern. That means the ability to distinguish, to evaluate. You weigh things to see, is there enough weight for them to be considered genuine or are they false? This comes with maturity. Immature people will say such things as we've seen here. And then third, there are those who say, well, I see nothing wrong with it if it's on a small scale or for a good cause. Well, there are several problems with this. Is the standard by which we're to operate based on my view, I see nothing wrong with it. A lot of people see nothing wrong with murder, but that doesn't make it right. Proverbs 14:12, there's a way that seems right to a man. What's the rest of it? But the end of it is the way of death. So it may seem right to me, but that wouldn't justify it. Is the sinfulness of an act determined by the degree of involvement or motive? See, I don't see nothing wrong with it on a small scale. Little gambling's okay. The problem is, it's very addictive. Very much like certain medicines, certain addictive drugs. And a little bit leads to quite a lot later. But even if that's not the case, We don't determine its sinfulness on the basis of its size. For example, is it wrong to steal $100? Now, I'm a cheapskate. I take the position it's wrong to steal a penny. But I think it's also scriptural to say that. Stealing itself is wrong. It doesn't matter the amount. Somebody says, well, a penny, that's inconsequential. That doesn't matter. That's okay. All right, 2 cents? 3 cents? Now, I think we'd all agree $100 is too much. At what point can we not add another penny and now it becomes wrong? There's no end to this kind of reasoning, and there's no logic to it as well. Is it okay to tell a white lie? You know, once you start telling lies, you get colorblind pretty quickly. It's wrong to tell a white lie. Okay, what does that mean exactly? Someone says, do you like my hat? No, I don't like your hat. That's rude. But if they say, you like my hat? Oh, I love your hat. And you go away and say, I think that's the sorriest looking hat I've ever seen. Is that a white lie? Is it okay to lie? You know, there are other lies that can be told. But whatever they are, they're very dangerous. Revelation 21 at verse 8 gives us an illustration of what happens when people begin to lie. Revelation 21:8 says, but the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars. Now, if you hadn't put the word all there, we might feel a little better about what we said about that hat, wouldn't we? All liars. What hope does that give us for little so-called lies? I don't know of any hope there. If all liars have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death, you want to test God and just see if he meant what he said? I don't. Gammon disagrees with each of these arguments. They make the point any betting or wagering, whether for money or not, no matter how slight or insignificant, where the outcome is uncertain or depends upon chance or skill, remember that word skill, constitutes gambling. Now I want to go over that again very quickly. Any betting, any, or wagering, whether for money or not, no matter how slight or insignificant, where the outcome is uncertain or depends upon chance or skill, constitutes gambling. Now, Ty called my attention to the fantasy sports. I have 4 pages here. This is going to take an hour. I hope. No, it won't. But I want you to point out this, that he's helped me to see that something I didn't even know existed, fantasy sports. In fantasy games, users build a team out of individual athletes. You pick out, say, in the majors, you pick out this guy for this position and this guy on this team for this position. Pick out ones you want. And they're not actually playing, but you're using them in these fantasy games. And the points are tabulated based on in-game actions. The providers of these games have argued their products require more skill. Now, they're using the word skill, just as Gammon did. They require more skill than chance, like in traditional gambling. Traditional gambling doesn't require as much skill. You just take whatever odds. Well, Pete Rose bet on the Reds because of their skill level. You can't take skill out of it. People who go and bet on the horses, they're going to bet on the horse with the what? The most skill, the most speed. And if he happens to have a bad day, then you lose. But skill works its way through gambling all the time. Now, further, welcome to America where sports betting is now technically legal. 6-3 ruling, the Supreme Court cleared the way for states to legalize sports betting, striking down a 1992 federal law that had banned the practice in most states. Samuel Alito pointed out supporters argue that legalization will produce revenue for the states, so states will get a lot of money. They got a lot of people on welfare, too. And critically weaken illegal sports betting operations. So we need to do evil that other evil won't grow. That's brilliant. which are often run by organized crime. So to get rid of organized crime, let's do what they do and beat them at their own game. Now, the opponents contend that legalized sports gambling will hook the young on gambling. We could put a period right there and hang your hat on it, and you don't need to go any further, because that's exactly right. Further, though, it will encourage people of modest means to squander their savings and earnings. I could read you stories all night on that subject. People who have lost everything they have, thinking they were going to win it all, and corrupt professional and college sports. Furthermore, ironically enough, both companies, the FanDuel and the DraftKings, have long argued that daily fantasy sports in which users can win cash prizes in exchange for cash entry fees is legal because it's technically a game of skill. It requires skill. It's not a game of chance. A lot of gambling requires skill. Now they're changing their tune. Last week, FanDuel CEO Matt King told Term Sheet that he's excited about the future. Whatever the decision is, he expects sport betting revenue to eclipse fantasy sports revenue at some point. He'll go on to say, it'll likely allow users to gamble on the outcome of games or point totals. Annually, illegal sports betting amounts to approximately $150 billion industry. $150 billion. And FanDuel isn't waiting too long to start taking bets from its users. And as Ty very astutely pointed out, they were denying it was gambling until it became legal. And then all of a sudden, well, it's okay. It is gambling, as everybody knew all along. And as the Tusk Ventures, Bradley Tusk, who invested in FanDuel, told Term Sheet, he expects another 25 to 30 states to legalize sports betting. As an investor, I couldn't be happier. And then it talks about the people at FanDuel, and then someone reviewed this by saying, of course it's gambling. CEO of the sports gambling company, William Hill, U.S. Of course it's sports betting. It doesn't mean that it's subject necessarily to the same laws. You're risking money on something of an uncertain outcome. To me, that sounds like gambling. Well, yeah, it is. And then in November, the NBA even announced it had become an equity investor, and FanDuel, making itself part owner of a company that it pays out more than $10 million in prize money every week. $10 million in prize money every week. Daily fantasy sports is a bridge to legalized sports gambling, because that's where the big money is, says Les Bernal, national director of Stop Predatory Gambling, a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. This man's very sharp. He goes on to say, he called it a complex parlay wager and said daily fantasy sports share similar traits with online poker because the entry fees of many lower income fish are pulled to feed the sharks who use data-driven strategies to win big money. Bernal has said his bigger concern is the effect it has on society. Quote, the question about daily fantasy sports isn't about shaving points. It's about shaving money from the wallets of low-income and middle-income people. And then finally this, sometimes the name you call it is important, said I. Nelson Rose, a gambling law expert. Calling it video lottery terminals is more acceptable than slot machines. If fantasy sports is gambling, calling it fantasy sports makes it more acceptable than sports betting. Just change the name, give it a euphemism. Instead of calling it stealing, call it legalized borrowing that doesn't give back, and everybody's happy. Except the family that starves and the people who commit suicide and engage in crime and all these things that continue to grow and siphon good from society. What's wrong with gambling? First of all, it's against God's plan. He authorizes gain, yes. He expects us to gain, but by honest work. It starts in Genesis 2, where God tells the man and the woman in the garden there's proper work that must be done. And it is a good work. Ephesians 4:28, let him who stole steal no more, whether it's stealing by permission or not by permission. Let him who stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands, a thing that is good, that he may have to give to him who has need. We exchange time and labor for money. Colossians 3 puts it like this, specifically to slaves, but a general principle is enunciated here. Verse 23, whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men. We know the Lord sees what we do, We want him to approve what we do. If he doesn't, we don't want to have anything to do with it. That's the basic concept. Now, 24, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ. That's the attitude, not only of a slave, but of a worker. If it's true of someone who's forced to labor for someone else, it's a million times more true of one who works voluntarily, who's getting recompense for what he's doing. Furthermore, in 2 Thessalonians 3, three verses here, verse 7, for you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you. How were you not disorderly, Paul? Even when we were with you, we commanded you this: if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. Paul worked with his own hands while they're building tents. Now, those who are such, we command and exhort through our Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness and eat their own bread. Now, suppose a person quits working and he just starts taking from others. That's the person who is not to be given anything to let him learn his lesson. And he's the person who is to be withdrawn from if he doesn't repent. Bartering also is a legitimate means of trade. So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest. And there were many times when they have the talents that he refers to here, the different sizes of talents. Sometimes it's a bag of gold or silver. They weigh different amounts. But we usually think of bartering with reference more to things than we do to money. Let's go to 2 Kings 4 for just a moment. It's sort of a preview of coming attractions on Wednesday nights, hopefully not very far from now. In 2 Kings 4, there's a case in verse 1, a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets who comes to Elisha with the message that, you know, my husband is dead, and you know that he feared the Lord, and the creditor's coming to take my two sons to be his slaves. I'm going to lose both my boys because I can't afford to pay what I owe. So Elisha asks her, what can I do for you? What do you have in the house? And she said, I have nothing but a jar of oil. That's not enough to pay the debt. So he said, go borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors. Empty vessels. Do not gather just a few. When you've come in, you shall shut the door behind you and your sons and pour it into all those vessels and set aside the full ones. So she went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons who brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out. And when the vessels were full, she said to her son, bring me another vessel. He said, there's not another vessel. So the oil ceased. The oil was very costly. So she came and told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil and pay your debt. You pay with oil. That's bartering. You pay the debt, and you and your sons live on the rest. They would have lived handsomely on that for a while. That's bartering. Perfectly fine. There are many occasions in the past of this country where an old country doctor would go out and he would help this family, and they said, we don't have a dime to give you, but we do have a really good cured ham, and it's yours. We do have 3 dozen eggs we can send back with you. And they would pay him, and whatever they could pay, that was bartering. He trades his medical skill for some of the food that they can share and have in abundance for him to take. That's authorized. There's benevolence. Luke 10 illustrates this with reference to the lawyer who comes testing Jesus in verse 25. What shall I do to inherit eternal life? He turns him immediately to the law. He said, well, it says, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength and mind, and your neighbors yourself. And Jesus said, well, you've answered your own question. Just go do it. Well, he still has to do something to justify himself. And so he says, but just who is my neighbor? That was a big question back in those days. Just who is my neighbor? Well, he said, there was this certain man that went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and robbers stripped him of his clothing and wounded him, leaving him half dead. Sounds kind of modern. By chance, a certain priest came down the road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Then a Levite, when he arrived at the place, came, and he passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, he saw him, he had compassion, he went to him, he bandaged his wounds, he poured on oil and wine, set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn and took care of him. The oil soothes, the wine is a disinfectant. On the next day when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper and said, take care of him. Whatever more you spend when I come, I'll repay you. He says, now you tell me which one's the neighbor. he can't bring himself to say the word Samaritan. So he said, well, he who showed mercy on him. He said, well, just go and do that. You know, you've answered your question again. Pretty simple, isn't it? That's benevolence. And that again is Ephesians 4:28. Let him who stole, quit your stealing. Steal no more. But rather, let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may what? Have to give to him who has need. You get now not this mindset that I have to get, I have to gather, I have to grow in riches, I have to become filthy rich. You want to help other people. You've become changed, and that's part of the many changes enumerated there in Ephesians 4 after the Lord got a hold of these people. There's also an inheritance that can be received. Paul says, now for the third time, I'm ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you, for I do not seek yours but you. And then he says this, for the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. You've probably seen the bumper sticker on the back of the huge, huge recreation vehicle that says we're spending our children's inheritance. They're going to spend it all before the children get a dime. In some cases, that's a good idea. But typically, the parents lay up for the children. They receive some kind of an inheritance. Gambling, is that a part of it? No. Gambling exploits other people. It takes from them and gives nothing of equal value in return. It's a special form of stealing. I was speaking on this subject to college students 30 years ago. And I said, gambling is actually a form of permissive stealing. And the fellow kind of lost his marbles for a moment. He said, gambling is not stealing. There's nothing stealing about it. They agreed on it. Let me have the permission to use words in a figurative way. It's stealing in the sense that you're taking from that fellow and not giving an exchange in return for what you received. So it's permissive stealing. Yes, it is. And it's also covetousness. Exodus 20, verse 17 gives a law that no mere man could ever enforce. God alone can enforce a law against covetousness. Covetousness is a greedy desire for other things. And it's at the heart of what we call gambling. A greedy desire for more and more stuff. Regardless of what that stuff is. And it has many objects of desire. 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Nor his male servant. Nor his female servant. Nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Now, if a mere man gave that law, somebody would say, well, how is he going to enforce it? How does he know what I desire, what I covet, what I yearn after? And unless he acts upon it, no one would. But God knows. He knows what we think, and he enforces this on us as well. This forbids the desire to take what belongs to another. It's a heart sin. We can't do much with heart sins. Except speak on them. We can't know when a person's guilty. God can. Now, this is basically the idea of lust and desire. You can lust after another person's money, his house, his wife, his slave, any number of things. The Septuagint give the word that in the New Testament is translated the greedy desire for more. And that's what we see in various passages. Paul says in Acts 20 verse 33, I have coveted no one's silver or gold or apparel. In Ephesians 5, it is very powerfully stated what God still expects of his people. If he expected this kind of high moral road on the part of the Israelites, he certainly wants his own people to do it. Verse 3, but fornication and all uncleanness are covetousness, let it not even be named among you as is fitting for saints. He talks about other things. Then verse 5, he returns. For this you know, that no fornicator, unclean person, nor covetous man. When he said, thou shalt not covet, this is one of the ones that's been brought into the new and given even more emphasis. Nor covetous man who is an idolater. The moment you covet, you break not only what they would have counted as the 10th commandment, but the first two as well. That's how serious he makes it. You've made another god in your heart. Now, 1 Timothy 6 verse 10 goes a little further and uses a synonym of covetousness. For the love of money, the love of silver, literally. The love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. We could just pause there and say, what is your worst indictment against gambling? 1 Timothy 6:10 pretty well does it. It's a root of just about everything bad that can happen. And we'll see that in a moment. Gold prospectors oftentimes in the Old West would pan for gold. They would, Alaska and all around the western part of the United States, they would dig for gold and they would dig for gold and dig for gold and dig for gold, and they live for that major vein they hoped to find that would make them rich, and then they could dig another one. They wanted that gold stuff to give them everything they've ever hoped for. Many of them died before they ever had anything. That's the same thing we're speaking about here. That's the motive behind this person who goes to the casinos and who participates in the lotteries and who uses his money that should have been spent on the education and the clothing and the food for his family. He spends it on himself, thinking, maybe one of these days I'll strike it rich and then I'll quit. No, he will never quit. Some of the most disturbed and lonely and some of the saddest people in our country are those who have won huge fortunes. I've seen interviews. Many of them have said, I wouldn't wish what's happened on me on anybody. I hope you never win a fortune like I did. I wouldn't wish this on anybody. But that's another lesson. The alcoholic can avoid temptations. Stay away from where it is. But think about it. Every time this gambler gets a check, he's tempted all over again. Every time he has another dollar in his hand, the temptation is renewed, and he has to fight this battle probably more difficultly than is the man who is the alcoholic. The golden rule, were to do to others the way we would have them do to us. In gambling, many must lose for few to win. It exploits others for profit. Could gamblers survive by practicing the golden rule? Here, I'd rather you win this than me. Here, you keep it. How long would he last as a gambler doing that? It wouldn't happen, would it? It produces evil fruits. We know things by virtue of their fruits. Specifically in Matthew 7, verses 15 to 20, Jesus is talking about false prophets. But he speaks of it in general terms. Therefore, by their fruits, you will know them. The fruits of gambling include, but are not limited to, addiction. It is highly addictive. Criminality, devastated families, suicides. 1 in 5 homeless people say that gambling contributed to their poverty, and yet many of them continue. One story that I read, and as I said, we could spend our entire time, another hour, just on the stories of what's happened. Catherine Avigna played blackjack on Friday afternoon into Saturday morning. At that time, her 21-year-old son paged her. Are you coming home tonight? She said, probably not. She played nonstop until Monday. Now, she started on Friday afternoon. She played nonstop. I've heard many say this. Until Monday, more broke and depressed than ever, and $7,000 in gambling debt. 2 days later, this is Wednesday, her son peeked into her room. He found 2 bottles of antidepressants with a suicide note. This woman, who had been an assistant attorney general for Minnesota, had everything going for her, but a gambling addiction destroyed her family and took her life. When Edward Irwin of the Southern Baptist Convention went with his fellow Baptists to Las Vegas, where they wanted their convention, why, I'll never know. He said, I saw a 30-year-old man crying in his mother's arms after he lost his savings. He's penniless. His pot of gold turned to a bucket of tears. We always ought to give things the smell test, because some things just plain stink. Ecclesiastes 10, verse 1, dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment. Here's something that is wonderful, but dead flies in it, totally different connotation. And cause you to give off a foul odor. Some things just give off a foul odor. They just stink. So does a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor. If you're not sure about something, give it the smell test. Galatians 5, for example. As we said in Hebrews 5:14, sometimes the New Testament gives specifics. Galatians 5 will give some specifics we must avoid. But then sometimes in the midst of those specifics, it will give general principles that govern us on things that aren't even specifically named. Galatians 5:19, now the works of the flesh are evident. Because they're evident, he can be both specific and general, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envies, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like. That's kind of like our etc. And so on and so on and so on. That means there's more to the list. But he doesn't have to name them because we know what else fits here. Then he goes on. Of which, I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in time past, that those who practice such things, notice again, he's used a general term to describe this. Those who practice things in this same category, I won't have to mention them all, will not inherit the kingdom of God. He talked about the fruit of the Spirit. What a contrast. We can know the difference. If we can't know this, we can't know anything. The smell test. We ask, will it help or hinder my influence? Matthew 5:16. Let your light so shine before men that they will see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Will this glorify our Father? In John 19, as Jesus is hanging on the cross, verse 23 says, then the soldiers, when they had crucified Jesus, took his garments and made four parts. So apparently there are four soldiers, to each soldier a part. This is a necessary inference. But then he says, and also the tunic. So there's one piece beyond the four. Each soldier gets a part. The thing left over is the tunic. Now the tunic was without seam, woven from the top in one piece. They didn't want to tear this thing in two. It would destroy it. So they said among themselves, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it. That means let's gamble for it. Let's see who can win it. Whose it shall be, that the scripture might be fulfilled, which says, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Therefore the soldiers did these things. We don't know which soldier won it. Whoever he was a loser in every way. Can you imagine, as he goes on to say, that by the cross there stood his mother, Mary, and some others. Can you imagine that they participated with those soldiers in that gambling? Can you envision them thinking about it? And then it mentions John, who is to take Jesus' mother home to take care of her, because Jesus won't be able to. Can you imagine John saying, well, I'll take you to my house in just a minute, but let me see if I can't win that tunic. Can you even imagine that? No, you cannot. That would stink. Furthermore, let me just mention, I know of an occasion in another state that I'll not name, where I went to a meeting and her brother had just entered the lottery and won. Part of the congregation in that state. He'd won the lottery and won. Of course, they were in the process of withdrawing from him. He repented, and I don't know whatever became of the money. He didn't keep it. But can you imagine that even in the Lord's church, people are this confused about something so obvious? Does it tug on my soul more toward earth or toward heaven? We're to be laying up our treasures in heaven, not as in Matthew 19, like the rich young ruler. I've got to hold on to this, and I want this and that. I want the best of both worlds. Will it make me a better steward or worse steward? Will I be able to put God first in all things, seek His kingdom first above everything, Matthew 6:33? Or will it hinder me? Will it stain my reputation and the reputation of my Lord and of His people? Romans 2:24 shows Paul scolding some of the Jews because they hadn't lived up to the standard they claim to follow. For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Let that never be said of us. Can I know that I will not become addicted? 1 Corinthians 6, 12. We know that we're not to be brought under the power of any. All things that Paul is speaking of are lawful, but he says, I'll not be brought under the power of any. In Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. You never reach a point where you say, I've had enough. You always want more and more and more. Listen carefully. We go back to another casino. 7-year-old Cherise Iverson's body was found inside a locked corner stall in the bathroom at the Prima Donna Casino. Killed after security guards warned her father 3 times about leaving her unsupervised as he gambled. Surveillance tape shows her playing hide-and-seek with 2 men in their early 20s. At 3:48 a.m., he was still gambling when she entered the restroom, followed by one of the men, who exited 25 minutes later. Her father, Leroy Iverson, tried to cut a deal with the hotel. He would not sue if they gave him $100 to gamble, free beer, flying his girlfriend from out of town, and money for the arcade for the girl's 14-year-old brother. To say that there are people who are so depraved that we cannot comprehend them is an understatement for a man like this who calls himself not only a father to this daughter, but a human. John Daly, the famous golfer, has been addicted to alcohol and gambling for years. He estimates he's lost $50 to $60 million in 15 years. Paul Harvey spoke of him from his autobiography, John Daly's autobiography, spending all night in a casino. He had won, before he went into the casino, he had won $750,000 playing golf. He lost $1.65 million just hours after winning that amount. Twice as much he lost. He's been married 4 times. It takes a toll. There's much more about him, but we don't have time. What I want the church to know about it? 1 Corinthians 10. What effect is this going to have on someone watching me eat food? That's innocent in itself. How much more so if it turns out to be something not innocent, such as gambling? Do I want brethren to know and to be made to fall because of my example? If everyone did it, would society be better or worse? To ask it is to answer it. Would I want others to win my possessions? You know, Galatians 5, at verse 14, tells us, for all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, you shall love your neighbors yourself. If I love them as myself, I'm not going to be taking from them because they wouldn't like to lose it. That alone would defeat gambling. Well, I asked Jesus to participate with me. We're to be following his example. Would you imagine Jesus ever entering a casino? Frankly, I can. I really can. I'm being serious. I could see Jesus going into a casino just as he went into the temple, turning those tables over, scattering that money every which way, getting people to run out scared for this madman. Yeah, I could see him doing it that way, but never to gamble. Obviously, he wouldn't go into a casino to gamble. Do not gamble with your revenue. Those who are supposed to be God's stewards, who are irresponsible, will be judged. Remember the one talent man in Matthew 25? Just because he didn't gain, he hadn't lost anything except he hadn't profited, but hadn't lost anything by gambling. Remember in Luke 16, the man who was the steward, who was held accountable for not having been faithful as a steward to his master. That's a picture of us. Don't gamble with your relationships. Don't do anything that will destroy your family, your children, the church. Pete Rose in 1987 wagered a minimum of $10,000 a day on the Reds games. He denied for years he did it. In his 2004 autobiography, My Prison Without Bars, he admitted finally he did it. He's barred for life from the great place for all ball players, the Hall of Fame, and properly so. And then don't gamble with your reward. In Matthew 10, he who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. He who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever gives one of these little ones only a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple, assuredly I say to you, he shall by no means lose his reward. These are heavenly rewards for givers, not for takers. For givers, not for those who merely seek to get for themselves. You have listened so patiently. Thank you very much. If anyone in this audience is not ready to meet God, then you're gambling with your soul. And recognize the seriousness and the danger that you're in. Would you come this evening confessing the precious name of the Lord, repenting of your sins, and being buried with baptism to rise and walk in a new life that puts Him first? If we can assist in any way, won't you come as we stand to sing?